This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark here, and I'm joined here with Richard Wollstonecroft. We're going to be starting things off talking about the 20th year anniversary of MUF, the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. Richard, great having you back on. I think the last time we talked was the 19th anniversary when Matt and I premiered Supply, and Matt's also here with us.
Yep, it's good to talk to you, Robert.
Matt Pegas.
It's a one-year anniversary since we last spoke. So, it's been an interesting year in the world, hasn't it? Really, it's kind of been very strange. And but you know, it was a great pleasure for us to play Supply last year. Great film, and we've got another bumper a year. It's our 20th anniversary this year at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, which has been described by a local new right kind of site as the festival the left loves to hate. Which I don't know. Not entirely sure. That's a correct label, but I think because we do try a few different things. I mean, simply because we do occasionally play a few things that might be new right, alt-right, or, you know, conservative or whatever, I guess that makes us de facto of that politics, I suppose, or something that would annoy the left. But, you know, obviously we play a lot of left-wing filmmakers. We play stuff from the LGBT community. We don't really, you know, it's just got to be interesting or a bit, you know, aggressive or a bit... something a bit different, you know, that's what we look for.
Something that would have a hard time finding a real berth in any other film festival is the idea.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of stuff we do, you know. I mean, last year we played Farmlands by Lauren Southern. No festival in Australia had played that. And we gave that best film. And I gave Steve Bannon best director for his Trump documentary, which I thought was funny. And I got a thank you from his team, which was very nice. But, you know... thought that would be a good, you know, kind of, I just think, I mean, I liked his documentary. I mean, I don't know if it was particularly well directed or whatever, but I just gave it as a bit of a tribute to Steve Bannon because I think he's interesting, you know.
He's been kind of out of touch with what Steve Bannon has been doing lately, but he's certainly one of the most interesting figures in American politics from the Trump era.
Exactly.
I know in previous years there's been political reactions to MUF and some controversies. Has there been any significant political news about MUF this year?
No. There's been nothing major so far this year. I mean, you know, it's still a month to the festival. We'll see how we go. I mean, I'm going to be giving a whole number of interviews, so God knows. Maybe they'll listen to this and, you know, get up in arms about something. God knows. But, like, I think, too, I mean, you know, I kind of defied them. You know, I mean, I mean, this year's theme is never apologize, which I'm a slight hypocrite because when I got into some trouble last time, I actually did apologize for the statement I'd made. Because it was, you know, it's kind of weird being under an attack, a social media attack. You know, it was around 200 people from the local industry and also just social media activists. And, you know, it just feels like you're, you know, being witch hunted. And not only were they attacking me, but they were contacting friends and, you know, demanding they get on Facebook and publicly denounce me. And it was most of them just ignored it. But some actually did get up and... denounce me though, which I thought was interesting. And then,
this was about that the LGBTQ controversy from about a couple of 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, it was you know, I made this. It was rather outlandish comment. You can see it if you Google it on Facebook. In my name and same-sex marriage or whatever. And then, but like, you know, the whole issue. I was not so much concerned about the actual issue of marriage, but that it would be a kind of slippery slope that if. That was then, you know, accepted. Then, you know, you'd see things like, you know, this agenda being taught in schools and, you know, children being, you know, encouraged to be trans and, you know, drag queens doing story. And I'm really glad none of that has happened. So, you know, I mean.
At MUF, are any of the films that are going to premiere of a political theme?
Pardon me? This year, it's really this year we're kind of really just celebrating the 20th anniversary because, you know, it's kind of, I've been doing this for 20 years now. It's kind of a long time. I've never, you know, committed to anything for so long. When I did the Hellfire Club, I did that for around 8 to 10 years. So, you know, I mean, this has been a long time. So, you know, it's kind of a bit of a year to kind of think of where we are and, you know, celebrate all the filmmakers we've discovered. You know, I mean, whether you like us or not, the festival raises interesting topics of debate. And, you know, I think that's always been what we've been about. I mean, obviously the last controversy, the same-sex marriage thing, I mean, that was never something I deliberately tried to invoke. It was just a silly comment I had on my Facebook page that I'd accidentally made public. For some reason, sometimes if I make public, say, 3 or 4 posts in a row on Facebook, this is kind of a, I don't know if it's a glitch, then it makes all of my posts from that moment onward public or something. So that's what had happened. Like I was promoting the festival. I'd put up some, you know, posters for films and things that I wanted to share publicly. And then I made some more outlandish comment I would have kept private just to my friends. And then for some reason that went out publicly. And then someone in the industry who is of the, you know, new left and an activist, you know, screenshotted it and then, you know, went viral and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's apparently a little bit of an organized attack on me. But, you know, even though I did apologize, I was going to resign from the festival for a year and then come back this year. But the festival, oddly enough, the controversy that was caused by it, we normally would get, say, 500 to 800 entries per year. But we got around 2,000, 2,300 entries. It, like, almost tripled the amount of entries that the festival got. So the effect was actually not to boycott it. It actually, you know, totally promoted the festival and really was actually, you know, made it 3 times more successful last year, apropos of entries anyway. And so, you know, I mean, I just, you know, decided to, you know, stay on as the director and, you know, kind of fight this thing. And obviously I oppose cancel culture and, you know, I don't mind apologizing to anyone from the gay community. I'm upset. I mean, it was not, you know, I was kind of, the comment I'd made was tying things into kind of globalist politics and the way that certain agendas like trans and the LBG community sometimes have been embraced by kind of places like CNN. I mean, you know, I mean, I had a conversation with Bruce LaBruce, you know, about the way that mainstream media had embraced the LGBT movement. Whereas in the 90s, when I ran the Hellfire Club, it was kind of more underground and stuff. And we were kind of, you know, just together. I mean, he's a far left winger. We were musing on why that might be. And, you know, obviously I have my opinion on why that might be. And, you know, he had his own. And that was sort of where it was coming from. It was slightly inarticulate. And I kind of wrote it as a kind of black pill post. It's the kind of post that you would write if you hated Donald Trump and then you woke up, you know, after the last election and Donald Trump is the president. So you think, oh, this is the end of the world. And, you know, it was that kind of post, you know. I mean, many lefties make those kind of posts and they get away with it all the time. But obviously my post was a bit outlandish and for whatever reason, it just, you know, went viral. And but really the thing is, I mean, you know, this is the first time I've spoken about that issue in almost a year. I mean, it's basically been forgotten about. And, and that's actually fine. And also because I did stay on as director, you know, I mean, these people who try and deplatform you and, you know, cancel culture and intimidate your friends and stuff, if you fight it, if you just stay on and if you say, no, I'm not going to, you know, I might apologize or I might, you know, say maybe I was a bit inarticulate in some of the things I said. But, like, if you just keep doing what you're doing, they just go away because they rely on you to kind of fall on your own sword, so to speak. And I was going to do that for a year, but I decided after the amount of entries I was getting, I thought, no, fuck this, I'm gonna fight it. And I went on Mike Retter's podcast. I was in Bali for a couple of months last year, and then with a friend, female friend, and then just decided to announce that I was unresigning, so to speak. And then that kind of went everywhere a bit too, and that got a little bit of press. But that was the last bit of controversy. And there's nothing too really controversial in this year's festival. I thought I'd keep it a little bit light on apropos of controversy this year because I just wanted to try and celebrate the achievements of the festival, you know, the amount of filmmakers we've discovered and, you know, the important work it's done.
How many films are going to air at the festival?
There's around 40 or 50 shorts and there's around 10 features. It starts on a Sunday and finishes on the Friday. And on November the 24th, it finishes on Friday, November the 29th. The opening night film is a local genre film called The Faceless Man, which stars a lot of great, you know, like Australian genre talent, people like Roger Ward, Andy McPhee.
And that's a horror film.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's actually almost like the perfect muff film. That's the reason I chose it, because, I mean, this we played a number of his shorts by James DiMartino, and, he's kind of very much in the style of the kind of film we like, and he made, I think this is his first feature, and it's really fantastic, and I just thought this is just the perfect opening, and it's almost like the perfect muff film, as if it was made for muff. So, you know, it's kind of got an irreverent sense of humour, and it's full of all kinds of gross out, this, that, and the other, and, you know, it's a really good opening for us. And on the closing night, we have the new Stu Stanton feature, There's No Such Thing as Monsters, another great local genre filmmaker. And also, Terry McMahon, last week, gave us his new 40-minute documentary, his first documentary. He's one of the filmmakers we regularly play his work. And it's called The Prize Fighter, and it's really brilliant. And it's about an Irish prize fighter who goes to America in Southern California. He's promoted by a Latino kind of promoter of boxing and stuff. And Terry made this really, really great film. And you know, he's someone of the not the new left, probably the old left, I'd say. But he's a pretty nice guy. For someone of the left, he's a pretty nice guy. For example, he was asked to denounce me when everyone was. And he said, well, you know, I have no problem making a statement about this. He said, but it's not going to be what you want to hear. And he made one of the best statements of all. He said, listen, Richard and I disagree on a lot of things. And but Richard's a reasonably smart guy. And if you actually listen to him a little bit, you know, I mean, he's quite reasonable. And you can talk your ideas to him. And you know, I mean, sometimes he goes off on a tangent. I don't like what he said. I totally disagree with what he said. But he kind of defended me. He wrote this kind of strong kind of defense of me, which is one of the best that came around. And another local filmmaker, I mean, look, I'm not going to name everyone, but a number of people who are of the either far left or the new left or even the old left were defending me sometimes. Like, they didn't like to see me getting kicked in this way. So I found that very touching. Whereas some people who are probably even maybe slightly of a right politics in private were publicly denouncing me, you know what I mean? And that was kind of hilarious, because I'd never had a problem with anything. I mean, it all hung around me for many years. They'd seen my Facebook page. They knew I was a bit, you know, new right or whatever. And they'd never had the slightest problem until, you know, until the witch hunters came around. And then, you know, a couple of them, so I'm not going to name who that was too, but, you know, I mean, look, you know, that happens. I think some people felt, you know, they had to do it because, you know, there's a sense, you know, in the industry, you know, it's like a kind of McCarthyism, you know, it's like you get blacklisted or whatever. I think people were worried about being blacklisted. So some people were making denouncements only because they thought, well, you know, and it was hysterical for about a week or two, but then it just died off. You know?
And Richard, you have a new film coming out soon as well, right?
I do, and I'm finally finishing it at the moment. It's being sound mixed this month with David Russell up at his studio from Snog and from Black Lung and also from Omni Recording Corporation, which is a really great, it does a whole bunch of really re-releases from the 60s and 70s. Looked it up online, Omni Recording Corporation. David's doing
Omni Recording Corporation, yeah.
And then we're going to do a quick grade up in Sydney, and Richard Grant is doing the titles, and yeah, it'll be finished by Christmas. And then I'm going to start entering into film festivals overseas, and obviously, hopefully, you know, it'll get an Australian festival screening next year. Hopefully, one of the bigger festivals if we're lucky, but you know, who knows? Knowing my reputation, maybe they won't. But you know, I think someone might take a chance on this one. It's definitely my best film. It's a genre film, a revenge film. Kind of a revenge tragedy. It's about a guy who is killing off these pedophile priests who had molested him growing up, and then, which is kind of timely with everything that's been going on with the Royal Commission here and with all the Epstein bullshit in the United States. And then he rescues a woman at one of these people's houses, and she's been raped by these five other guys. And so he decides to bump off these rapists as well. So, and I call it, it's like Me Too with teeth. You know, that's what I call it. It's and then, you know, very along the way, various toes get stepped on, and it involves like a local Melbourne gangster. He becomes involved in the plot, and there's this crazy band of kind of alt-right neo-Nazi characters, and then there's a Roger Ward plays an Ulster loyalist, and it all just goes mad, you know. And I'm rather proud of it. I think I wrote the script with Matthew Clayfield. We did around 9 drafts, which is probably the most drafts of any script I've ever done. we worked on it quite a bit, and, you know, obviously making it improvised here and there, and I'm quite proud of the results. So, you know, that'll be out next year.
So, out of the featured films, you mentioned the two horror films, including The Faceless Man. What are some other films that are going to premiere?
There's a whole bunch of stuff, and I've got the website here. That way I can just read directly from it. Number of the features. We're playing a feature called In Full Bloom. That's an Australian, New Australian feature, I believe. Locusts is another very interesting Australian film we're playing, which is getting a lot of heat on it. Another Australian one called, we're definitely pro-Australian, so, you know, we're a little bit nationalist, perhaps, in the sense that we like to play a lot of Australian cinema. Life on Earth, Severance is a new feature from Australia by Angelo Salamanca. We're playing 1,000 Kings is a new film from Germany that we're playing, which is very stylistically stunning and an amazing film. We're playing a film called You're Not Thinking Straight, which is the first feature of a hot new kind of avant-garde filmmaker from Australia called Luke Sullivan. He's got his second feature. I can't remember its title now, but just Google him. You're Not Thinking Straight, Luke Sullivan. His second feature, check that out. It's playing the art circuit here, and it's just really brilliant. I went to a screening organized by Bill Mazulis about a month ago. It was fantastic, and that's where I picked this film up. And there's a film called Phornasis from France, which is one of the foreign films we're playing, which is really great, and directed by Aurelia Mengen. Maybe she's thinking of coming out for the festival, which would be great. She'd be the international guest if she makes it. And, you know, we're also playing a whole bunch of shorts, you know, I mean, from a whole bunch of, you know, our regular filmmakers, and, you know, they come from, you know, overseas and all over the place. New films from Jamie Wilson and Matthew Collins, and, I mean, I could just list off a whole bunch of names here, but some of them you might not know. But, you know, I mean, we're just doing what we normally do, which is, you know, a whole bunch of features, new shorts. You know, I'd say about 60% from Australia, 40% overseas, and then, you know, our opening and closing night, and that's it. We're keeping it quite compact, because I've had a very, very busy year trying to finish this film, and just, you know, there's just been a whole lot going on. I started doing I guess they're podcasts, or whatever you call it, video casts on YouTube. They're called The Report from Tiger Mountain. I don't know if you've ever seen one of those. So I started that with the Unshackled, which is kind of Patriot New Right site here, which I've become friendly with the people who own that and run that, and they encouraged me to do it. So I went ahead, and I've done maybe 20 of those so far. And they're also shared on Affirmative Right, the Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki site that was obviously originally founded by Richard Spencer before he moved on. So, you know, I've just been pretty active doing a lot of stuff. I had another holiday about, you know, 6 weeks ago. I always like to take a little holiday before doing Muff, because this is kind of my very busy time. Like right now, I'm just, you know, I've got to run around like a blue-ass fly today. So, you know, so it's quite busy. But, you know, there's a lot going on in the world. So, you know, it's a very interesting time. And it's, and in about 3 months, it's the 20s again, the roaring 20s is again.
Yeah. No, it'd be interesting to see the decades change over, and if that, obviously, just the mere name of the year isn't going to change anything, but just that we're entering into a sort of new era, perhaps. The Unshackled, that's the website where
yes,
we can check you out?
You should all be aware of that and check that out. It's a really great Australian site. It's run by...
Yeah, well, it just looks like, I'm looking up now, it looks like pretty high production value.
It's really good. Tim Wilson...
Oh, almost 8,000 subscribers, yeah.
Oh, no, it's really, really good. And, you know, they're a great bunch of young guys. Morgan Munro, Steele Archer, and Tim Wilms, they're the three main guys. And, you know, they encouraged me to get involved. And, you know, so I've been doing my kind of iconoclastic new right-leaning you know, podcasts and having some fun with that. And so, I mean, I'll be doing a few more right now, but I'm just so flat out at the festival. And once everything's locked down with, you know, for example, the catalogue is printing this week and all various things. So once that's all, you know, happened, maybe next week I'll be able to, you know, do a few more of these reports and get them happening again. Because, you know, I do enjoy... you know, I guess it's become part of my persona, and, you know, one of the reasons, you know, I mean, funny thing about this whole you know, public shaming or my last controversy, I did always keep my politics a little bit separate from the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. But oddly enough, after this, you know, they've kind of like forced me not to in a way, or that I don't become ashamed of it or whatever, or not ashamed of it, or I don't keep it, you know, under a hat, so to speak, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I just talk about it openly now, and I think that's a great situation, because I think we all should be able to talk about our politics. And, you know, I mean, I get along quite well with reasonable left-wingers, and funnily enough, reasonable left-wingers get along well with me. And, you know, I get along well with some anarchists. I get along well with some fascists. I get along well with some libertarians. I mean, you know, so you can get along well with all different kinds of people if you just keep an open mind and, you know, and you're reasonably articulate. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a very interesting time we're living in, really, but it's also a time of crisis. I think we can all see that.
Yeah, we were making this point in our podcast on the Joker, and you also recorded a podcast on the Joker for Affirmative Rights, and how the film The Joker really represents the zeitgeist of the era that we're entering into.
I really think it does, you know, and I think it's a great film, and, you know, I mean, I think Richard Spencer denounced the film a bit. Richard Spencer, you know, talked about The Joker, somehow it represented loser nationalism. I'm not entirely sure how that comes out of that particular film. I think the film, you know, it's about someone who is alienated and kind of isolated and, you know, kind of forced against the wall, really. And, you know, it's kind of, it is a film like Taxi Driver, and it's also maybe a film like King of Comedy, that's the film I'm thinking of course. Mm-hmm. Two Scorsese films, and obviously it almost references him, also by casting De Niro in it. It's a definite reference. So, you know, I mean, I think it's open to different kind of political interpretations, but the film definitely has a kind of new right kind of feel. There's a kind of, you know, that society is collapsing and that it's pushing people to extremes. Obviously, it pushes one individual to become, well, the Joker. I mean, the thing I liked about the film is that it was done as if it could actually happen. I mean, so many of these Marvel films that have been, you know, rightly criticized and crucified by Scorsese and Ken Loach and Coppola recently. I mean, I hate this. I mean, I've liked a couple of them. You know, a couple of them aren't so bad. But as a whole, I haven't seen them all, but there's about 20 or 30 of them. I've seen maybe 10 or 15 of them, and I'm just sick to death of them. I find this a much better kind of way of, you know, doing the superhero thing. And also, I did enjoy the Christopher Nolans. You know, I mean, I really liked the last two Christopher Nolans, the one he did with Heath Ledger and the one with Bane, I thought was a masterpiece. And also, I was a fan of the Tim Burton films in the 80s, the two he did, the first one and the one he did with the Penguin, Danny DeVito. So, I mean, you know, it's not like, I just think we've been flooded with superhero bullshit, and this is very refreshing. And the way this film has made so much money, too, you know, it's been the most. Is it the most successful superhero film of the year? I hope so.
And I believe so. Yeah, it can even be categorized as that. Certainly, it's broken some records, and it's a rare occasion where I'm happy to see that happen. Usually, when I hear about a film doing well financially, it depresses me because most films that do well financially are trash. But this one's good.
In the podcast I did with Colin and Andy, I said we should definitely claim this film for the new right. I mean, one thing that kind of annoys me a little bit about the new right, the alt-right, whatever, the dissident right, there's various names and things, is that, you know, there's a lot of division in it. There's a lot of infighting with people arguing with each other about this and that. I'm sure you're aware of this. You guys aren't too. I think you got into an argument, didn't you, Matt, with somebody on the stage?
But like, no, you might be thinking of... easy mistake. Someone similar to me would be Pilleater, who's the other co-host.
Oh, right.
I steer clear, but Pilleater doesn't.
You know, it wasn't you two. It was Pilleater. He got into a fight with somebody. I mean, look, I've been into little fights with people, maybe. But what I say is like, oh, I've had a disagreement here. Okay, just, you know, calm down, you know, whatever. And
well, the thing is, I noticed is you're actually still relatively pro-Trump. A lot of people in the dissident sphere are really... pretty much have rejected.
They're black-pilled.
Yeah,
they don't think. Well, it's interesting. I would say Richard and the affirmative rights sphere in general is probably the biggest, the most pro-Trump wing of what used to be the alt-right. It's interesting.
I'm definitely still, you know, really pro-Trump. I mean, obviously he's not perfect. You know what I mean? But like, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. You know, I still really like him. I mean, one of the reasons. Is the way the mainstream media still hate him so much. You know, if they start liking him, that's when I'll probably go off him. You know, the fact that they hate him so much mean that he's still some kind of existential threat to them. So that's clear proof that he's some kind of trouble. And then also the way that they, you know, that Guy Rosenstein tried to bring up mental health issues and then the whole Mueller probe, which was 2 years of bullshit, and then they've just invented some new nonsense from the Ukraine to try and impeach him. The way they've done this again proves this. He's up to something that's against what you'd call the globalist agenda or the New World Order agenda or the, you know, at least the, you know, some elements of the elite within Washington. And I think the fact that he's challenging them is really, really interesting. I know you, for a while you guys supported the Yang Gang. I mean, what happened to the Yang Gang? I think...
He's still around. I think Yang is... He's actually polling pretty decently, I think. Let me look up his recent polling.
For me, support of Yang with also a certain degree of support for Trump are not, at this point, mutually exclusive. I mean, obviously, if they were running against each other, that would be a time to make a decision.
I think not. Is this... Well, this poll claims 9, but I've seen some that have him at, like, 5 and 5th place.
He's doing pretty well. It's unlikely he'll get the nomination, but I guess my point that I want to make is that support for Yang at this point I don't think it necessarily undermines support for Trump. I think that's the kind of dialogue that's coming from Yang is the kind of thing I'd like to see on both sides of the political spectrum, whether that influences future Democratic candidates or Republicans.
I mean, when a number of you, I think you guys and even Richard Spencer was a fan of him for a little while there, and I certainly looked into him, and he certainly said some interesting things. I think suggesting some kind of like almost like artist wage or some general
universal basic
universal basic income. But he didn't say like an artist wage, but he did say somewhere on a tweet that said art should actually be profitable, and he has addressed that whole issue. Should be economically viable. So Richard, what are your general thoughts on the whole concept of a UBI, basic income?
Oh, no, I'm a big fan of it. I think it's great. And I think it would be great for a lot of my American friends, you guys included, obviously. So I could understand, that was quite... And you know, when people kind of float these kind of vaguely socialist things, I mean, I would consider myself to a certain extent something of a right-wing socialist. I mean, I'm not like Castro. I don't want to Castro the economy. I mean, when I talk about being a right wing, I'm talking in a mild way, where you keep capitalism, but you just, capitalism is a vast profit machine and a vast, engine for making money. Well, I mean, when you put all these, you can definitely just, skim a little off the top and do a lot of very interesting things.
Yeah, and I think the other important thing, and this is a classic New Right perspective on it, is that, capitalism is well and good, and not to be a socialist in terms of being pro-egalitarian, because that definitely goes against what it would mean to be right-wing, but simply that it's really important that the economy and the market remains under the thumb of culture. And I think the classic New Right answer is to just acknowledge that there should be certain limitations and sanctions in place to make sure that the market and capitalism doesn't run amok, because otherwise it's just globalism.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's my point. I am a nationalist. I don't think I'm a radical nationalist, but I'm certainly a mild or even middling nationalist. So, I mean, I like nationalist economics. I like a lot of things Trump's done in relation to tariffs or things that have boosted the job figures and lowered the unemployment figures and various kinds of very positive economic news that have come out of Trump's. And, obviously Steve Bannon was pushing this agenda as well. I actually agree with a lot of this, and I think this is much preferable to the globalist outsourcing because there's this attitude that by outsourcing everything, somehow we're helping foreigners, but we're not helping foreigners by, giving them a crap job where they work a dollar a day to produce rubbish or, Like, it's way better to give, say, a foreign country debt relief from the IMF and then get them to, like their wages to be lifted to more like a Western standard. The reason all these companies go to all these foreign countries is because they can literally pay people $1 or $2 a day, and this is incredibly exploitative, and I don't support it. It's not good for us because it destroys our industry. It's not really good for the foreigners because you need to be lifting their wage, not just keeping it in this exploitation.
It also ravages their culture and produces a kind of globalized monoculture, which again, bad for them, bad for us.
To globalism, as it's seen economically and as it's being implemented. And I think that, Trump is a very strong... if you look at the kind of politics that are of interest to the new right or the alt-right, this and the right, Trump is without a doubt the strongest contender. Not only that, he's going to win, probably. You know what I mean? unless they impeach him or unless they somehow get this rubbish from the Ukraine to float, which I don't think they will. Trump's very slowly been taking apart elements of the cabal that's been out to get him. obviously the whole Epstein thing hit, which was, you know, huge news, the whole weird mystery around him dying. I mean, that's obviously how they control our politicians.
Do you think Epstein was murdered to cover up the people involved?
Well, look, I mean, there are three possibilities, and they're all, I don't want to guess on the percentage, but, I mean, I would say the two main possibilities are he was killed, because there's just too much weird stuff around, you know, the fact that the cameras had gone off and the guards didn't know what else. That's just bullshit. He was in a cell where you're meant to be watched, you know, a suicide watch, even if he'd technically gone off it. Obviously, you know, he was just, you know, he knew too much. Well, the other theory is that he was taken from the prison. But see, someone like Epstein would have what's called a dead man switch. Someone who was involved in that high level of blackmail would have, you know, videotapes of Bill Clinton and various people like that. And, you know, that, in a sense, gets him a get-out-of-jail-free card to a certain extent. There are two theories, that the cabal broke him out and he's in Israel somewhere, or that Trump has him under military guard and he's singing like a bird on the globalist cabal and telling, you know, Trump and his, you know, kind of Q operatives or whatever, you know, what's really going on and all that kind of horror story that some people, well, it does appear to be at least partly true with Epstein and, you know, Nexium and a whole bunch of this stuff. You know, I mean, you know, Pizzagate became real. I mean, everybody thought, you know, in mainstream media it was all a fiction, but like, you know, I mean, things like James Elefantis and, you know, what's his name, John Podesta. I mean, the main reason that hasn't been investigated is because clearly there are a lot of members of the GOP who would be customers of that service. So Trump would have to be very cautious about fully investigating it because, you know, I mean, you know, I wouldn't say who, but Mitch McConnell and, you know, God knows who else, Paul Ryan, there would a few of those kind of people would if that was happening, would have been probably customers of that. Who knows? So, you know, I mean, I think Trump has to be careful and almost surgical about the way he takes down this thing in some ways, because there are clearly people on his side. I mean, even that, what's the name of that lawyer who was from, he was implicated with Epstein, and yet he comes out and speaks for Trump, and, you know, so, you know, it's all, you know, it's a very fascinating kind of nightmare, all this stuff. But, you know, I think Trump is still the strongest horse, you know. I mean, who are they going to run up against? The only other candidate that interests me, and this might be controversial to say, is Bernie Sanders. I have always liked Bernie Sanders, but they gave him his first, you know, a heart attack so far this election. And, I mean, could have just been, obviously, natural causes or whatever. But, like, last year he was cheated of in 2016, he was cheated of the you know, nomination by Hillary. And, I mean, for whatever reason, they don't seem to want to run. The Democrats don't seem to want to run with Bernie. Though I think he is very interesting as a left-wing populist. I think a lot of his economic ideas are a bit outlandish, and he wants to run with that AOC, who's completely insane. But, you know, I mean, there's still some interesting things about him, but I don't think he'll get the nomination. I don't know what they'll do. I think they're relying on impeachment more than anything else. What do you think?
Yeah, they do seem to be really pushing this impeachment. And, yeah, Bernie definitely won't get this nomination. And he came close last election, but it looks like he's pulling about, like, fourth place. And
Who do you think's going to get up? Is it going to be Elizabeth Warren or...
Yeah, if I had to guess now, I'd say Elizabeth Warren.
I tend to think Elizabeth Warren as well. I think there's a world in which it goes to Biden, but I think if I'm a betting man, I'd bet on Elizabeth Warren.
I think Biden's too dirty. I mean, the whole thing with this whole Ukraine scandal, I mean, and this whole move to impeach Trump, it's ridiculous. What's clearly been going on is that Joe Biden's son is like the bag man, you know, has been collecting money in the Ukraine and also in China on these two companies, you know, to bribe Biden. And that's essentially what Trump was kind of looking into. Now, I think Trump has a right to do that as the president of the United States, to investigate corruption, you know, within high levels of government. I mean, is it politically motivated? Well, probably, because he's his potential main opposition. But, like, I mean, he's within his rights as the president to investigate this stuff, because there's definitely something weird going on there. And, you know, I mean, you know, I think, obviously, Epstein, well, I mean, there is a slight possibility Epstein did kill himself. I mean, you know, he could have been someone, there's a rumor he was a Mossad agent, and that someone at that level, once they had, you know, been, what's it called, caught or imprisoned in this way, they might fall on their sword and commit suicide.
The thing is, he already had a suicide attempt, and he should have been under, like, a lot of scrutiny, or under constant surveillance, and there was a whole thing where they didn't have footage, and he should be constantly watched, considering how high profile he is, and the risk of suicide, and It's hard to say what happened, but there's a lot of suspicious signs.
There's something really dodgy going on there in all that, and it does all tie into the kind of, you know, Pizzagate kind of thing, but not just as it relates to the particular accusations in relation to Comet Pizza or all that silliness, but as a kind of meta concept. There's some kind of like
strategy
for blackmail that the globalists use to, you know, control our politicians, because so many of our politicians often turn out to be sex criminals, but they also seem to act in a way that's not good for the country. And obviously what's going on right now in Europe with Brexit is, I mean, this is what's incredible with Brexit is, like, they voted to leave like 3 years ago around the same time as Trump, and they still haven't done it. I mean, this is the first time in my lifetime and my grandfather's lifetime that a British election has been technically ignored because the elite don't like the result. Obviously, they're going to have another general election, and I think, you know, they'll probably do okay, the Brexit things, and they probably will get it through, but the level of sabotage that's been going on is extraordinary. The Queen herself came out and said, you know, my government is here to enact Brexit. And, you know, the globalist Speaker of the House, Bercow, was like, oh, yeah, whatever, the Queen, okay. And then he just, you know, went on trying to sabotage it. It's extraordinary the level of, what would you call it? They really are trying to, you know, bring on their takeover attempt or whatever you call it. But the thing is, it won't work. I mean, obviously, they've never thought it fucking through. This is no way it will ever work. If necessary, the Queen will call in the fucking army, for fuck's sake, or, you know, declare a state of emergency or something. I mean, you know, I mean, and this is what I think is going on. In a way, what's clever about Trump is he's making all the enemies of our countries reveal themselves. And they are. People like Schiff and Schumer. And I mean, there's just a long, long list of assholes. And they're just constantly outing themselves. And then when they're looked into a little bit, it's dodgy. You know, and they're up to dodgy things. And that Trump has every right to investigate it. So there's a war going on. You know, and I came up with this idea called elite replacement theory. That's what I think is going on at the moment. That, you know, a lot of the elite in Western countries has been taken over by the globalist kind of, you know, agenda, so to speak. But I think, you know, with Brexit and with Trump, there's a slow movement behind the scenes to bring in more nationalist, more patriot kind of people, and replace the globalist elite. Now, I think some of the globalists we could probably work, they aren't involved in major criminal activity and that they can, you know, ameliorate their beliefs a bit to accommodate, you know, some mild nationalism that actually protects our countries. It's not like everything about globalization is evil. Some levels of free trade within countries are a great thing. I mean, there are good things about globalization. I mean, there's a difference between globalization and the globalist agenda as well. So, you know,
it's an interesting concept you bring up with elite replacement theory or whatever it was you called it.
Have you written an article on elite replacement theory?
I have. You can link to it. It's on The Unshackled. Just put in Elite Replacement Theory, The Unshackled, and my name, and you'll get that essay. It's also published on Affirmative Right with Colin Liddell.
So, I think it's an interesting concept for something like what used to be called the alt-right and whatever we are now, the new right, various dissident right movements, because these groups, it's a very aristocratic sort of Nietzschean hierarchical philosophy that is very elitist, but it's also anti-elite. It's anti the existing elite. So it's sort of anti-elite elitism, which at end game would be elite replacement.
Well, let's face it, it's the idea for a new elite or a new order. I mean, you know, if you want to use that, not a new world order. I don't know. Maybe it's the globalists want a new world order. Maybe they should come speak to us. I mean, you know, if they really want to take over the world, they should talk to people who might know how to do it. I want where's my invite to Davos and the Bilderbergers? You know, I'll tell them how to fucking do it. I need one cheap lunch or Soros could afford it. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. But like, it's a very, very strange state of affairs that we're in at the moment. But obviously something is going on behind the scenes, and I think it's quite exciting. And one of the reasons I like Trump is he's like a dynamo in the middle of all this. And, you know, he's still at it. You know, he's still doing his thing. And he's not, as I said, he's not perfect. And he doesn't always deliver on every single promise he's made, but he's delivered on a hell of a lot of them. And he's always constantly upsetting the right people, which is always a sign to me that he's still doing at least something very interesting. And, I think if you see it dialectically and look at the broader picture, I think we're involved in a long game here, you know. And, things like Epstein even breaking again, like, you know, he was charged 10 years ago. I mean, you know, they tried to link Trump to Epstein, but, like, Trump was, you know, I mean, he made that happen, let's be honest. I mean, the reason he was charged last year was because Trump would have been like, yeah, go get that cunt. And he was
what
like...
What do you think about the criticism that Trump has gone more in a direction towards, like, mainstream conservatism?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, Trump is pragmatic, you know, and he has to be pragmatic. I mean, you know, people like Richard Spencer that will sometimes criticize Trump a lot. I mean, someone like that, I mean, he's the president of the United States. He's going to have to make some compromises. He's going to have to make some compromises even with the Democrats at times. So, I mean, you know, I mean, like, the people expect, I mean, you know, does Spencer expect to wake up in, like, a white nationalist state because people voted for Donald Trump? I mean, something like that would be a 20 or 30-year process. You know, it would involve voluntary deportations. God knows what. I mean, I don't, you know, support that idea at all. But, like, I mean, something like that is not something you just, you know, vote for and then, oh, there it is next week. You know what I mean? Like, it's a gradual move to the right. And you see it happening all over the world. You see new right, populist right leaders taking charge or becoming very powerful in various countries all over Europe and also countries like Brazil. You know, and it's not like there are no problems. You know, there are problems on the new right and in the populist right. You know, I mean, well, you know, there are problems in all kinds of politics. And I think it's important that we be self-critical as well. And, but, you know, I think it's a changing of the guard, you know, which is this elite replacement theory that I speak of. You know, I mean, I've never been someone who goes to protests and marches in the street. I've always been a kind of think tanker or writing essays. And, you know, I think that's a very interesting way to affect culture. And to me, that's, you know, a good way. I think you do need to do it top down.
We were talking about this with David Cole the last show we did, Robert and I. The question is, do you remain optimistic about all this? Because obviously there was a great run globally for, you know, people of a more nationalist persuasion from, say, you know, 2015 through last year. Bolsonaro was elected, but it doesn't seem like we've seen as much in 2019 of this, you know, of a continuation of this. And I have some concerns that there could be a swing in the opposite direction. I guess I'm just curious how you think this will continue, or if the momentum is still on our side, or to me things feel a little bit stagnant right now.
This is a huge epochal change that we see going on. You see Steve Bannon talk about it at times. You know, things like Trump and Brexit, that's just the beginning. That's stage one, you know what I mean? And there's probably three or four stages, you know, that we're heading towards that will take even 10 or 15, 20 years. You know, like, this is a long process, and it's kind of literally resetting hitting reset on the computer, or on the world computer, so to speak, the Weltanschauung, or the, you know, techno-scientific world picture, hitting reset on that a bit. And, you know, I'm really positive about Trump. I mean, I'm a big fan of David Cole. I like a lot of his essays, and he wrote a very wonderful essay defending me. But, you know, his hatred of Trump kind of annoys me at times. But he can also... But, like, I mean, you know, I mean, for whatever reason, you know, I think he deleted me off Facebook or something like that of late. But, like, you know, I really like David Cole. I think he's great. I wish we could be friendly again. You know, I mean, sometimes he's, you know, stubborn dislike of Trump. You know, I mean, I think Trump is really something, you know. And, I mean, he's really doing a lot of interesting things. And I think he's just starting. Obviously, I believe he'll win the next election. So you're in for another 6 years of this, or 5 years of this craziness. And then God knows what will come next. Something new. Something that may be a bit more towards what some of the original alt-right or dissident right or might like. But it's going to be done in stages. It's not just going to happen overnight. It's going to reset things. Something like the way that mass immigration has happened over 50 years. Say we're going to, you know, attempt to make our countries more like us. I mean, but you should, you know, I mean, I'm a real supporter of nonviolence and stuff. This can be done by encouraging people to go back to their own countries, giving them money to do so, blah, blah, blah. This can be done without anyone being nasty. And, you know, I mean... The idea that, you know, I mean, for example, Morrissey, a figure like that who's kind of quite connected to the left, he's a vegan and things like that, the fact that he supports, you know, I think it's a Britain First or one of these, you know, large kind of new right, alt-right, far-right kind of parties, and it goes on American, you know, shows like Jimmy Kimmel or whatever, wearing a badge for whatever and upsetting everybody or whatever. I mean, you know, this is a major thing that's happening. And I mean, look, you know, who knows? Maybe the globalist agenda or the liberal agenda will crush this new nationalism. But I think this is just beginning, guys. You know, you're only seeing the orchestra warming its strings. And that's why I'm very optimistic. And I think Trump, you know, while he might not always be perfect, what you would say at a level of policy, I think at a meta level, he's fantastic. In the way he's very politically incorrect, the way he says what he thinks, and the kind of... bleed-on effect all over the world of something like that is huge, and you can't underestimate it. And that's why it makes him, you know, hands down the most interesting candidate, and why I think everybody on the right should continue supporting Trump. They can have their doubts about him, sure, and they should encourage him. Ann Coulter's encouraged him to be tougher on legal immigration, which he should be.
Yeah, criticism is healthy, and whether it's criticism from the right or the what's going on with the gang, and there's criticism and just having, like, so Yang's obviously not going to win, but just having, like, or who knows, he could win, but it's a long shot, but just having, like, competing ideas yeah, well, out there, and it just adds to the dialogue and the political process.
Universal health care and the universal, is it universal income, is it what it's called, or the basic income?
Actually, Yang supports universal basic income. Bernie supports a federal job guarantee, which is a different program.
Yeah. I mean, they are different. You couldn't do both. You couldn't do universal health care and a universal basic income, but you could do one of them, you know? And I mean, if I was Trump, I would probably not do something as radical as Bernie is proposing.
Well, that's the thing with Trump is, when I said there's criticism of Trump from mainstream conservative, going a mainstream conservative direction, your initial response was that he, from their perspective, maybe he's too soft in the national question. But I do think if Trump hypothetically were to go a little bit to the left, or to go a little bit, like, maybe not, obviously not Bernie Sanders socialism, but support maybe a soft version of socialism, that would really shake up the political dichotomy. But Trump has actually gone, like, way, like, his economic policy is pretty much standard conservatism that has gone back to, like, Reaganomics.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, all this, you know,
well, no, I guess not everything, because he does have, like, the tariffs on really, China. But on a significant portion of issues, he has.
China, to me, I believe China is the silent partner of the globalist agenda. Obviously, I think the globalist agenda is essentially to destabilize and possibly destroy Western civilization. Obviously, it's not a great idea because a lot of people who are globalists live here, so I don't think that's a very good idea for them even. I think their plan itself is self-destructive to them. So we need to explain that to them and say, listen, guys, this is not a good idea for you as well as us. I think, you know, Trump's done a lot of interesting, this trade war with China, and he's constantly doing very interesting things in relation to, I mean, the fact that the unemployment figures for African Americans and Latinos and Asians and women are at the lowest ever in American history under Trump, and not someone like Barack Obama, says that, you know, this is not business as usual for a GOP. He's totally transformed the GOP. I mean, not completely. Obviously, there's a lot of, I mean, to me, I've always been suspicious of what's called libertarian economics. I am fond of some aspects of libertarianism in relation to culture and in relation to social theory, not radically, but some of it. But in relation to economics, for example, the freedom of billionaires to be able to, you know, loot and rob, you know, and somehow we get a trickle-down effect, that's just absolute nonsense. I have no interest in defending the rights of billionaires. I would like to see them taxed a lot more. And their companies and all these loopholes closed. And if you were to do that, you could afford probably all these things you're talking about, including the universal basic income, that, you know, Bernie's this, that, and the other. And if Trump is smart, he will at least give a milder version of that. Because the problem with some socialist thing is that if it's done too quickly or too radically, it does Castro the economy, or it does, you know, turn it into the USSR. And you can never see that happening in America. So, you know, I mean, you just do it mildly. And Trump is doing it mildly. And that's what's good about him, the fact that he is mild. You know what I mean? And, you know, he's quite smart. And, I mean, a lot of people think he's dumb, but, I mean, he's played a very interesting game, in my opinion. And I'm still a huge fan, and I predict he will win next year.
Before we wrap up the show, Richard, do you want to plug Muff one more time? And
sure.
For people in the audience, like, where they can find out more about the lineup and the films that are going to premiere?
If you want to check out what we do at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival, go to muff.com.au. Michael Cheney is the webmaster this year from my film The Last Days of Joe Blow. He's putting the website together for us. The film festival is on November 24 to November 29 at Cracked Actors Theatre, which is at Level 1, 34 Lakeside Drive, Albert Park, which is a very central location. Last year, we kind of had a venue that was out in the boondocks because of the controversy. We thought we'd wanted to be a bit out of town just in case we had a lot of protesters. But we didn't get any, so, you know, now we're back at a big venue in the main part of town, in a very groovy area, and the venue is fantastic. It's run by lovely people. So and you know, check out the films we've got there, check out the history of what we've been doing at MUF, and Google around, and you know, come, if you're local, come and be part of the festival, or just join the conversation in relation to it on online and on Facebook. You know, I joined Instagram recently, and there's a MUF Twitter as well, so I'm doing all that nonsense too.
Richard Wollstonecroft, it's been an excellent show. Thanks for being on.
Thank you, Robert, and thank you, Matt. Great talking to you both. And you know, so yeah, keep considering Trump. You know, I mean, he's a very interesting figure, and but you know, there's no reason we can't criticize him. And there's also no reason we can't see positive things in people like Yang that occasionally have good ideas, and same with someone like Bernie Sanders. And let's continue this idea of elite replacement theory and balance the world out again a bit more. And let's all get invitations to Davos and drink champagne with all those rep bags over there sometime.
All right, we'll have to have you back on again soon.
No, my pleasure. It's been great talking, guys. Have a great day.
Take care.